Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And hello, thank you for joining us for a very jolly episode of the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Joining me today is David Bates, host of the podcast Pints with Jack, and we're talking about C.S. Lewis. In our previous episode, we talked about the secret life of C.S. Lewis, everything about the man you didn't know. You've probably heard about him, but many things you didn't know. One of the most important evangelists and apologists for the Christian faith of the modern era, and it's a reputation well-deserved. We're going to be talking more about that today, getting into the wisdom of some of his arguments and ways of presenting the faith that I think all of us should model in our various interactions and dialogues. So, David, welcome back to the Council of Trent.
It's lovely to be back here again.
Well, I want to, though, pick up on just a few things on Lewis's biography we did not have time to get to in the previous episode, because they also do weigh in on some of his apologetics and his theology. So misconceptions people have, they think he's an Englishman. He was actually born in Ireland. And some people think that he was a bachelor, and he was a bachelor for a while, but he ended up getting married later in his life. Tell us about that.
Yes, he spent nearly all of his life as a bachelor. But with his celebrity came many, many fan letters, and it was something that he took very seriously. He spent several hours each day replying to them. And he had one letter from an American poet and writer by the name of Joy Gresham. And the two quickly developed a firm friendship. She visited England and then eventually moved there with her two sons. Unfortunately, the British government was then starting to threaten to kick her out of the country. Mm-hmm. So Lewis offered her a civil marriage. He said, it's not going to be a real marriage before God, just a piece of paper so you and the boys can stay in England.
And so he committed green card fraud, basically.
He did.
But I mean, it was a marriage. It's following the laws of England, you know, so, okay.
Exactly. Unfortunately, not too long after this happened, Joy was diagnosed with cancer. If you remember in the previous episode, his mother had also died of cancer.
Right.
And she wasn't expected to live long. And suddenly faced with the possibility of losing her, Lewis started to realize the depth of his feelings for his friend.
Right.
And so the two were then actually married by an Anglican priest at her hospital bed. Mm-hmm. And that clergyman, he laid his hands on Joy and prayed for her because he'd had some success in healing before. And Joy went into remission for about 4 years, some of the happiest years of their lives.
Wow.
But then the cancer did eventually return, and you can read probably the best book to ever give anybody after the death of somebody close to them is A Grief Observed. It's raw, it's real. You get to see a real difference between the Lewis who wrote The Problem of Pain.
The academic.
Yes, and the firsthand A Grief Observed.
Which is so interesting because one thing that drove Lewis's atheism was the death of his mother. And so it seems like that same pain has now come back to hit the stronger Christian Lewis. And he doesn't pull any punches. Like he it's almost as if he takes the view, I can't be an atheist, but I can still be mad at God.
Absolutely. He follows in the tradition of the Psalms. You don't deny the existence of God, but you can certainly rail at him.
And so that's how he feels after the death of his wife. And then his children, I guess they would be his like adopted stepchildren?
Yeah, his stepsons.
Okay.
Douglas and Davy.
And then at this point, would they still have been young children or older?
Yes, they were still pretty young.
Oh, wow.
They were still at boarding school. He continued to look after them. Mm-hmm. And Douglas in particular is somebody who champions Jack's work around the country and actually around the globe.
Oh, okay. So, but through Grief Observed, his faith takes a hit and something to understand and meditate upon, but he still retains his faith even until his death in 1963.
Absolutely. If you watch the movies, The Shadowlands, it portrays it bleaker than I think it really was. This wasn't somebody who was just about to return to being an atheist.
Right.
But he was certainly somebody who was deeply grieving.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's acceptable. Sometimes we think in the Christian life that because we're Christians, our grief can't be something that endures, but to lose the relationships we have in this life is to experience a real kind of loss. And that's healthy to be able to grieve that.
We follow a Lord who wept at Jerusalem. Right. We follow a Lord who wept at the tomb of his friend.
Lazarus, yes.
And Lewis says himself in The Four Loves, to love at all is to be vulnerable. It's actually one of my favorite parts of Lewis because he actually takes on St. Augustine. Because St. Augustine, in his Confessions, speaks about the loss of a friend. And he draws the moral of the story don't love something that you might lose. And he therefore says, well, therefore love God, because you'll never lose God. And Lewis, he loved Augustine, but he said he was going to respectfully push back. He said, that kind of a mindset really appeals to me. I'm a safety first creature.
Right.
But he says, but to love at all is to be vulnerable.
Right. To have a real love we have for anyone, whether it's a friend or a spouse, we have to be vulnerable. If we never let our guard down with other people, then we're always putting on a show for them. We're not having these real fulfilling kind of relationships. And the same with God. If we don't let ourselves be vulnerable to God, then he's really just our boss. He's not really our father or our Lord. You know, he's just kind of an employer we're behaving under. You also say that his death was overshadowed. He died on November 22nd, 1963.
Mm-hmm.
Famous date in history, anyone might remember what happened then.
Well, there were two other people who died that day. One was Aldous Huxley, and the other one was President John F. Kennedy. That was the day he was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, as you can imagine, that is what filled the news. And so Lewis's death was a very quiet affair, and there were actually only a handful of people at his funeral. His brother, Warney, had always struggled with alcoholism, and after Jack died, he just went to the bottom of a bottle of whiskey and never came back up.
Oh, wow.
So he wasn't even there.
Now, what's interesting is that Peter Crave, I'm willing to give the mantle of the modern C.S. Lewis, has really kind of inherited the mantle here. He's written a series of dialogues, and one of them, and C.S. Lewis appears in them, Socrates appears in many, but Lewis appears in some of them. One of them is the dialogue between heaven and hell. I think it was written back in like 1981, 82.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a dialogue imagining in heaven that moment when John F. Kennedy, Aldous Huxley, and C.S. Lewis all arrive there at the same time.
Yeah.
And what their conversation would be like from a Christian, a more liberal Christian, and then someone who's more an atheistic materialist like Huxley.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it portrays it well there.
And Peter Kraft has released a new book with a very similar kind of setup,
right.
Symbol and Substance, where it's a conversation between Billy Graham, J.R.R. Tolkien, and C.S. Lewis with a very similar kind of idea. I actually heard one person, when they were speaking about Peter Kraft, they went, Americans, we have, he's sort of the, they said of Lewis, oh, he's like the English Peter Kraft.
Well, that's always nice to hear. So, all right, well, Peter Crave gets his due then. So it's always like whenever I hear people say that Ben Shapiro is a Catholic, is a Jewish Trent Horn, I always appreciate, like, oh, well, that's always nice to hear, as opposed to me being the Catholic Ben Shapiro. But, you know, I
think you need to get a cup that, rather than leftist tears, it needs to say sinner's tears or something like that.
Right. Let's talk then about the genius of Lewis's work. So we've talked about his life and what's come from that. Let's talk about the genius of how he articulates the Christian faith and makes it understandable to people. So one point you bring up here in our, what we've been going over to talk about in this dialogue, is the idea of a common Christianity. Now, what's funny is some Catholics and Protestants are critical of Lewis,
mm-hmm.
because he stops at what is called mere Christianity. It's like, well, that's not good enough. Why are you stopping there? But Lewis saw merit in doing that.
Absolutely. A lot of people have very odd ideas about this, and I always just send them back, go and read the preface again. He explains what this is and why he's doing it. So in Mere Christianity, he's defending mere Christianity. He's not trying to water down the faith. That was one thing that Lewis really couldn't stand. What he was trying to do was defend the basic Christian beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he was doing this because he didn't feel that anybody else around him was really doing that. And he said, you know, better scholars will be spending their time on the denominational disputes.
Yeah, they're talking about the finer points of disagreement between mm-hmm. Catholics and Protestants or Anglicans and other denominations.
But he said he wants to defend mere Christianity. And he said this isn't a lowest common denominator, watered down kind of Christianity. He regarded it as a highest common factor that we find across all of the historic Christian denominations. And he said that was where the line seemed thinnest, so to it I went.
And that, honestly, that's how I feel when I choose the subjects of my own books to write. Because, you know, you'll have Catholic authors, there's all different kinds of subjects Catholic authors approach. Like, I'm never going to write a book on Mary. Because mm-hmm. there's a gazillion books on Mary, and probably one of the best books was written by my boss, Tim Staples, Behold Your Mother. I don't need to write in that area because it's been done. I don't need to write a book on the deuterocanonical books of Scripture. Gary Machuda has a good book on that. But for me, like, the reason I wrote Why We're Catholic is because I racked my brain and thought, well, wait a minute. There's a lot of books about Catholic subjects, but where's that one book just on why you should be Catholic you can give to anyone? And I was not aware. The only book I knew that I had given to others that had affected me in my conversion was Rome, Sweet Home by Scott Hahn. And that book is helpful, especially for people who are Protestant. But it's not even as helpful for atheists because Hahn was a Protestant pastor before he became Catholic.
Yeah.
So to have something, and I think this might be something Lewis was dealing with, like, okay, you've got great books for Protestants to become Catholic or Catholics become Protestants or these, you know, different, you know, caring about God more and living out your faith. But what about just the average man in the RAF, the British Royal Air Force, who thinks it's all a bunch of hooey? What do we have to reach him? And so he stepped forward to fill that void.
Exactly. And for the longest time, my standard books that I would give people would be Mere Christianity to get them that far, and then something like Rome, Sweet Home or Crossing the Tiber or something like that to finish them off. And so I was very happy when your book came out because now I only had to give people one.
Instead of having to, and that's what I used to do. I cobbled together multiple books to read this book, then this book, and this book. It's always easy. Here's just one. So let's talk. I'd like to talk. Well, did you have a thought on that?
I was just going to say, against these charges that he was just watering down the faith, I'd actually say that he was saying something that you hear very clearly out of the Catholic Church, and particularly JP2's encyclical Ut Unum Sint,
right,
where he quotes John the 23rd, where he says that what unites us is much greater than what divides us.
Right.
That those other discussions are very, very important, but we do need to sit back and for a moment and recognize the fact that we all worship the same God. We believe that Jesus walked out of his tomb.
Right. And I think this is important because some people have this idea that, well, if you want to get someone to convert, you should just get them to be Catholic. And I really feel like that's true. I want them to become Catholic. But I really feel like, especially if you're dealing with an atheist or a non-religious person, there really is a chain of becoming Christian first and then seeing which denomination is correct. Mm-hmm. I think most people go to Mere Christianity first. I know I did in my conversion experience. And then I look to see what church made the most sense of just this basic Christian belief in God and the divinity of Christ. But let's talk about that basic belief in God, because I want to talk about some other arguments Lewis puts forward people may not be as familiar with. I had a friend request from the other day a resource for a relative of hers on the subject of knowing that heaven is real, but not one that's religious, one that's more philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, it's kind of hard to prove heaven just from philosophy. But then I thought, I'll give you one argument. The Argument from Desire,
yeah,
by C.S. Lewis. And that might be helpful if you want more than just a biblical defense of heaven, but a philosophical one. Tell us about Lewis's Argument from Desire.
Honestly, this is my favorite argument for the existence of God. It's not the most rigorous of philosophical defenses that you will ever find. And it certainly isn't in Mere Christianity, where Lewis doesn't present it as a syllogism and qualify all of his terms.
Right.
But he communicates something that I always feel just resonates very deeply within me. And he starts off by saying, the world around us disappoints us. It's just inevitably going to let us down. And he asks us, well, how are we going to respond to this? And he says that there are three main ways. The first is the hedonist way. If your car disappoints you, if your job disappoints you, if your wife disappoints you, just get new versions of all of them. If you don't have enough money, go get more.
Just get what makes you feel good.
Exactly.
Find whatever will make you feel good.
And the belief that there is something out there that is going to plug that gap in your heart. The other way, he says, is you can just be a stoic and just accept the fact that life is going to let you down. But he says that the Christian draws a different lesson from this experience. He says that creatures aren't born with a desire unless a satisfaction for that desire exists.
Mm-hmm.
He says a baby feels hunger, well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim, well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire, well, there's such a thing as sex. And here's the line that just resonates in my soul. He says, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world.
Mm. So we have this desire for God or perfect happiness. It cannot be satisfied in this life. Our desires are not in vain. They do have a corresponding object. Therefore, this desire must be satisfied in the next life, heaven or eternal life with God.
Yeah. And Peter Kraft, he tidies up Lewis's argument and offers some slightly more rigorous philosophical categories to show that this desire is real and it has an object.
You know, what's funny is I'm sympathetic to this argument. I agree, like if I was in a debate, I wouldn't put this argument out there because to me, it's more of a non-rational argument, not an irrational one. But I also call it intuitive, or you either see it or you don't. Mm-hmm. For example, in Why We're Catholic, I offer a similar intuitive argument about Jesus, that the very name of Jesus causes a discomfort in people that other names do not. And I believe that's evidence behind the unique power and identity of the person of Jesus. Now, that is, you know, that's been criticized by other people who I think take my argument too literally. It's not like I'm saying this is the best evidence for Jesus, mm-hmm. but just that for some people, we'll see that and say, oh, yeah, and other people won't. If you don't see it, that's fine. And I think it's the same with your argument for desire.
My other favorite one is, there is the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, therefore there is a God.
Yes, that's Creef's, I think, in his 20 arguments for God, I think that's number 18.
He says you either get this one or you don't.
Right, and I think that's the case, and it's okay to present that. Now, I've thought about the argument for desire, and I've always put on my philosopher's hat, and I always try to debunk my own arguments I use. What's hard for me is I can think of a few desires that I don't believe have a natural corresponding object. But perhaps they don't. My silver bullet I used to go to before talking to you right this very moment was most people have a natural corresponding desire to change the past, to not have made certain mistakes. It's universal, but it's impossible. It can't be done, even for God. But perhaps that just means not that we have a desire to change the past, but we have a desire to live a perfect, moral, and upright life. Mm-hmm. And that's really more the desire that we have. And that is one that will be satisfied in the next life. And so, because there's other desires, you know, I have a desire to fly. No, not really. There are desires that are passing. But most, you're right, most desires we have. Now, of course, someone could be hungry and there's no food, but there is such a thing as food.
Exactly.
That's the point.
It doesn't have to necessarily be filled for everybody always.
But the kind of thing must exist for the desire to make sense.
Exactly. And I think it also helps to go to the transcendentals. Look at truth, goodness, and beauty. These are things that we want without limit. Mm-hmm. You know, we're never satisfied with just one new fact. We want another. We're not satisfied with a little bit of beauty. We want more beauty. And even the most beautiful things, there still comes a point when you read Shakespeare and you say, well, is that it? I want more.
Right. More, more. Every toddler does a little sign language. More, more.
I thought you would go with Oliver. Please, sir.
Please, sir, can I have some more? You want more? And then there's that Family Guy where Stewie's there and he pulls out a gun and says, all right, drop the gruel, put it in the bag, please. Let's move on to another typical Lewisian trait. That's his use of analogies. Mm-hmm. And I myself, in doing my apologetic work, I try very hard to use analogies because I think that's how most people understand things. If you just explain it, it just goes over people's heads. The key, I believe, to being a good teacher is to make a good analogy so someone can see, oh, X is weird. I don't get X. Well, X is like Y. Oh, I get Y. Oh, now I get X. That's the idea. And Lewis does that very well.
And it creates that indelible memory around which you can then reason. That's one of the wonderful things about parables. When you remember the story, you can now start thinking through some important moral and philosophical ideas because you have the story on which to hang it.
Right, because you might say, you should forgive other people because God forgave you. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. There was a story once about a king who forgave a servant's debt, and the servant was a crummy person and didn't forgive the other guy's debt. Oh, wow, what happens in the... So analogies also can kind of have a little bit of a story element to them, and, you know, Lewis is the artful storyteller.
Absolutely, and he does it all the time, particularly in Mere Christianity, because, it, as you say, it puts an image in your mind, and it's something that you remember, and it also touches you in more than just simply your intellect.
Right.
Lewis called the imagination as the organ of meaning. And reason being the organ of truth.
Right.
And you really have to have both. And he just does it throughout Mere Christianity. But one of my favorites is when he's talking about morality.
Right.
He talks about the different parts of morality. But he does it by asking his readers to imagine a flotilla of boats. Mm-hmm. The number of boats going across the Atlantic Ocean. Again, given World War II, this is something that was regularly happening.
Right.
And he said, for this flotilla to successfully arrive at their destination, three things have to be true. One is that they have to stay in formation. They can't just be crashing into one another, otherwise they're not going to make their destination.
Right.
They also have to be working well internally, because if all of the gears and everything are jammed and they need to divert, they're not going to be able to, and they'll start bashing into one another. And lastly, is this like a teleological idea, they need to be going in the right direction. They need to be going to the right port. And then he then draws that back into the realm of morality, because people are very quick to say, oh, we should treat other people well. That's right. There's very little argument there. But as soon as you get to the idea that there is an internal morality, people start getting a little bit more antsy about that. But with Lewis's example, you can see why it's so important. Because if my internal gears are not working, if I'm not in control of my machine, inevitably I'm going to start bumping into other people. This is why the Catechism talks about chastity, in particular abstinence and fasting. It's so that we can control our body rather than our body controlling us.
Right. So I say, oh, we'll just treat other people kindly. Right. But if I don't treat myself kindly, and if I dwell on angry or hurtful thoughts, if the machinery inside's not working, I'm going to crash into somebody else. Just like, and the flotilla reminds us that you need, the ship has to work on the inside. The ships can't crash into each other, and all the ships have to reach the right destination together.
Exactly.
And that's all of us in the moral life. We have to be able to regulate our internal moral processes, treat each other well, and we all should be ordered towards kind of the same end. I agree with you, the analogies. Like, I remember reading, you know, Mere Christianity, gosh, probably over nearly 20 years ago. And it still sticks out to me, the moral law, the analogy he used. He talks about the man sitting on the bus, and he's like, well, that's my seat, not like, give it to me. Like, it's a rule. It's my seat. Mm-hmm. You took my seat. Like, there's this rule you broke, not just give it to me, I want it. Or it's my orange. You know, I gave you a bite. You ought to give me some too. And they're very simple examples, but they still stick with you after a while. And that's what we have to do in our presentation of the faith, is to come up with these simple examples for things to get people to understand the more complex things.
As well as think about them afterwards.
Right. And so that they stick, because for me, there's a book, I'm going to have to look it up here now. I think it's called Make It Stick. Here it is. Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning by Peter Brown. And so he talks about that, the idea that great ideas aren't just the idea itself, but that you've incorporated mechanisms into it that people, they won't forget them. Let's talk about a few other areas where, especially areas that people don't know as well, because obviously Lewis is well known for the trilemma, Lord, liar, and lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think some people are unfair with Lewis on this.
I completely agree.
Because they think, well, C.S. Lewis, Jesus might have been a legend. You never think about that? How do you know? Maybe he wasn't a liar or a lunatic. He's just a legend. But obviously, Lewis knew what legend was. He wasn't ignorant of this. He was making a different kind of argument when he comes to the identity of Christ and using that trilemma.
Yes, and he even sets up what he's assuming. It's somebody that is reading the New Testament and giving us, okay, these are Jesus' words.
Right.
Therefore, who is he? And he's attacking the person who says, oh, well, he's just a wise preacher.
Yeah, he's talking about just the general British guy who hears the sermons, hears the homilies. Oh, he's just a nice man, and just assumes that from the Bible. And he's basically just correcting people's misreading of the Bible.
Exactly. It's sort of like when some atheists complain about the Kalam cosmological argument and say, but it doesn't even mention God. It's like it's not trying. It's setting something up for a further argument.
Right. Lewis is knocking out that Jesus is not a lunatic or liar. He's Lord. And then if you disagree with that, we'll go back to the reliability of the Bible, whether it's a myth, things like, you know, other things like that.
And somebody steeped in literary criticism like Lewis would have been fine going to that.
Yeah.
Actually, even before he converted, I think even to theism, one of his colleagues, who he described as the most hard-boiled atheist he knew, he commented on the New Testament about its integrity and historicity. And he said it is quite incredible, that dying and rising God almost looks like it happened once.
Almost. You know, you can't quite bring yourself there, but even others who understand literature and myth can see this is not a simple fabricated story. Let's talk a little bit about Lewis's defense of Christianity and the idea of the purpose of Christianity. Because at first this may seem intuitively obvious. We say, well, what do you mean the purpose of Christianity? Like, what's it for? He has some profound insights here.
And this was the biggest thing I took away from reading Mere Christianity week by week over the course of the podcast, because you couldn't rush through. And it's a really interesting question, just to ask Christians that you know, what is the purpose of Christianity? Because they can come up with lots and lots of different purposes, you know, to gather together on Sunday, to be good people, to serve the poor. And Lewis just kind of cuts all the way through that, and he says that the purpose of Christianity is to become another Christ, to put on Christ. And he even says that Christianity offers nothing else, that this is the purpose of everything, that gathering together, even the greatest and most holiest of things, it is still for that end.
Right.
And in Eastern Christianity, I go to a Byzantine Catholic church, we call this theosis, the idea of the transformation.
We go to a Byzantine Catholic church. You've been there longer. I'll give you that much.
I didn't want to call you out.
Okay. No. I've come out. I have come out of the doors, not the closet, but the sanctuary with the doors, to say that we haven't switched rites or anything, but we do frequently attend the Byzantine Catholic Church, same one that you attend, at which the concept of theosis would really boil down here.
Exactly. It's to participate in the divine life. Lewis says that we receive our natural life. He calls it bios, our natural life from our parents. But what we really need is zoe, supernatural life from God. And he says that we receive that principally through faith, through baptism, and Holy Communion. He says these aren't the only ways, but these are the principal ways through which we receive this life. And this is meant to transform us. And he comes to another one of his wonderful analogies. He compares it to tin soldiers coming to life.
I remember tin soldiers. Yes, in Mere Christianity, when I was reading through, that really struck me. I was in the Civic Center Library. And it's always funny when you read something profound, in like a song, it like takes you back to that very moment. This happens to me a lot with audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear...
I remember which junction I was at in my car.
Where you were driving your car, where you were riding your bike. And I remember, because the Civic Center Library in Scottsdale has this large atrium area that you can just sit in. I remember reading, just being struck by the tin soldiers, which Lewis proceeds with the analogy in this way.
And in the same way that the trilemma makes an appearance in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, this idea also makes an appearance in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when Aslan goes to the witch's house and breathes on the stone statues, and they come back to life, echoing both Pentecost and the harrowing of Hades.
Mm-hmm. So then, for our listeners, obviously aren't as familiar, how does he take the tin soldier to apply to our spiritual lives? Like, that's what God does
That's what God does to us, the indwelling of his spirit. This all comes out of Peter's epistle, where he talks about that we have become partakers of the divine nature.
Now, what's interesting here is that this is one of those things that a Catholic reader reading through this will just see Catholicism screaming through.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that off-putting to Protestants, because many Protestant writers will talk more about that the purpose of Christianity is just to have our sins forgiven and then to be right with God.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll talk about sanctification. Of course, we're sanctified, we grow in holiness, but not necessarily that's an after effect, not the primary purpose. But Lewis wouldn't necessarily see the division there.
No. And I think the more you're exposed to Lewis's thought, the more you see this everywhere. He preached this wonderful sermon called The Weight of Glory. And he effectively made the point that we forget who we deal with day to day. The person who rings up our groceries at the grocery store, the people that we work with and that we walk past. He says every single one of those is going to live forever. He says you've never known any mortals. We are all going to live forever. And we're going to live in one of two ways. We're either going to be a heavenly creature or we're going to be a hellish creature.
Mm.
And so he brings these images. Which do you want to be?
Which do you want to be? A question that we all need to answer and help other people answer as well. What are some resources that you would recommend for others who would like to learn more about C.S. Lewis? Let's say someone's listening to us and says, oh, C.S. Lewis is great. And they see the corpus, like there's so many books he's written and books people have written about him.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you recommend people go first, like which C.S. Lewis books to read or resources, and then resources about C.S. Lewis you think would be helpful?
Well, obviously, they need to go to pintswithjack.com and follow us.
Obviously.
Watch our videos, listen to our podcast, because we're going to be breaking this stuff down. We are not experts. We're just amateurs who just love Lewis and want more people to read him. So get stuck into some of his books.
See, British people can make anything sound great. If I say I'm an amateur, people are like, who's going to listen to Trent? Don't worry about us. I'm an amateur. Like, oh, that's wonderful. Anything sound great. But although when I travel to other countries, my American accent is actually prized. I was in, I think I was in Germany, but I met some women from England, or it was from the British Isles, I think. And they said, oh, say that again. I love how you say it. I'm like, and I was saying, you mean a tomato? Like, oh, lovely, says tomato.
Tomato.
It's a tomato. It's a tomato, Bates. So pintswithjack.com.
And then get stuck into his books. You've got a choice of genres as to what you think you might prefer. If you like apologetics, go read Mere Christianity. If you like stories, go read the Chronicles of Narnia. They are wonderful. Lewis said that a children's book that isn't worth reading as an adult wasn't worth reading as a child. And the Chronicles of Narnia are gold. And they've actually just been picked up by Netflix, so they're going to be remaking all of them again soon. Mm-hmm. I would also recommend two of my other favorite books are The Screwtape Letters, which is another one of these imaginative supposals. It takes the form of a series of letters written by a senior devil to a junior devil, his nephew. And he's giving him instruction on how to tempt his patient, his Christian, to get him to turn his soul towards hell.
Right.
And it's wonderfully creative and a wonderful work of human psychology as well to realize the ways in which we start thinking and get steered away from the good, the true and the beautiful.
Right.
And one of the real lessons in that book is Screwtape, he doesn't really care what the patient chooses, just how are we going to twist it to send him to hell.
To even take something good and make it bad.
Exactly. It's a very Augustinian idea that evil isn't a privation. Oh, sorry, evil is a privation. It's not a thing in itself. It's a too much or at the wrong time or in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And that's the lesson that you really get from the Screwtape Letters. And then my personal favorite is The Great Divorce, mm-hmm. which is another one of these imaginative supposals. Lewis asks, what would it be like if souls from hell could go and visit heaven? Mm-hmm. Would they even want to stay? And it takes a case study approach. So pretty much in each chapter, you meet a new ghost, a soul from hell who is visiting heaven. And you get to see why they turn back. What souvenir of hell are they unwilling to let go of in order to enter into heaven and joy?
Mm. I remember that one, actually. I was driving with some friends during my pro-life missionary work. That was back in probably 2010. And we used to drive across the country to our different campuses to set up exhibits. So we were driving through, I think, Arkansas, heading our way to Georgia, the University of Georgia. And we played it as an audiobook. And actually, many of Lewis's works are available as audiobook. And I think that's one of the best ways, honestly, not just to read Lewis, listen to a highly produced audiobook.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the way he would want them to be heard. I don't know what you think.
Oh, no, I agree. And there's a theater group that has gone around the country producing The Most Reluctant Convert, which is a theater production of Surprised by Joy. They've done The Great Divorce. They've done The Screwtape Letters. It really definitely lends itself to that medium. Because, again, we're getting back to this idea of imagination being the organ of meaning. Mm-hmm.
And I have been meaning to remind people to go and check out your podcast, which is
Pints with Jack.
So check out pintswithjack.com. And thank you all for supporting TrentHornPodcast.com so we can have a lot more interviews like this to help build you up, to share the faith in homage to someone great like C.S. Lewis, to go out there and present our faith with imaginative wonder to help people encounter the real Jesus. So, David, thanks so much for being with us for these two episodes.
I very much enjoyed it.
And thank you all for being with us, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.